Frank Sinatra not only defined a style of singing, he defined a lifestyle that was flashy, sometimes crude, and shared by a small group of buddies who were fellow celebrities like Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr., the Rat Pack. One of the most famous accounts of Sinatra's life during his heyday was written by journalist Gay Talese and first published in Esquire magazine in 1966. It was called Sinatra Has a Cold. Talese read an excerpt of it for the public radio program This American Life. We're going to play that reading for you now.
Frank Sinatra, holding a glass of bourbon in one hand and a cigarette in the other, stood in a dark corner of a bar between two attractive but fading blondes who sat waiting for him to say something. But he said nothing. He had been silent during much of the evening, except now in this private club in Beverly Hills he seemed even more distant, staring out through the smoke and the semi-darkness into a large room beyond the bar where dozens of young couples sat huddled around small tables or twisted in the center of the floor to the clamorous clang of folk rock music blaring from the stereo. The two blondes knew, as did Sinatra's four male friends who stood nearby, that it was a bad idea to force conversation upon him when he was in this mood of sullen silence, a mood that had hardly been uncommon during this first week of November, a month before his 50th birthday. Sinatra had been working in a film that he now disliked and could not wait to finish. He was tired of all the publicity attached to his dating the 20-year-old Mia Farrow, who was not in sight tonight. He was angry that a CBS television documentary of his life, to be shown in 2 weeks, was reportedly prying into his privacy, even speculating on his possible friendships with mafia leaders. He was worried about his starring role in an hour-long NBC show entitled Sinatra, A Man and His Music, which would require that he sing 18 songs with a voice that at this particular moment, just a few nights before the taping was to begin, was weak and sore and uncertain. Sinatra was ill. He was a victim of an ailment so common that most people would consider it trivial. But when it gets to Sinatra, it can plunge him into a state of anguish and deep depression, panic, even rage. Frank Sinatra had a cold. Sinatra with a cold is Picasso without paint, Ferrari without fuel, only worse. For the common cold robs Sinatra of that uninsurable jewel, his voice, cutting into the core of his confidence, and it affects not only his own psyche, but also seems to cause a kind of psychosomatic nasal drip within dozens of people who work for him, drink with him, depend on him for their own welfare and stability. A Sinatra with a cold can, in a small way, send vibrations through the entertainment industry and beyond, as surely as a president of the United States suddenly sick can shake the national economy. For Frank Sinatra was now involved with many things involving many people. His own film company, his record company, his private airline, his missile parts firm, his real estate holdings across the nation, his personal staff of 75, which are only a portion of the power he is and has come to represent. He now seemed to be also the embodiment of the fully emancipated male, perhaps the only one in America, the man who can do anything he wants, anything, can do it because he has the money, the energy, and no apparent guilt. All the way. All or nothing at all. This is the Sicilian in Sinatra. He permits his friends, if they wish to remain that, none of the easy Anglo-Saxon outs. But if they remain loyal, then there is nothing Sinatra will not do for them. Fabulous gifts, personal kindnesses, encouragement when they're down, adulation when they're up. They are wise to remember, however, one thing. He is Sinatra, the boss. Il padrone. Or better still, he is what in traditional Sicily have long been called uomini rispettati, men of respect, men who are both majestic and humble, men who are loved by all and are very generous by nature, men whose hands are kissed as they walk from village to village, men who would personally go out of their way to redress a wrong. Frank Sinatra does things personally. At Christmas time, he will personally pick dozens of presents for his close friends and family, remembering the type of jewelry they like, their favorite colors, the size of their shirts and dresses. The same Sinatra can, within the same hour, explode in a towering rage of intolerance at a small thing being correctly done for him by one of his paisanos. For example, when one of his men brought him a Frankfurter with ketchup on it, which Sinatra apparently abhors, he angrily threw the bottle at the man, splattering ketchup all over him. In Las Vegas, after the last show at the Sands, the Sinatra crowd, which numbered about 20, all got into a line of cars and headed for another club. It was 3 o'clock. The night was young. They stopped at the Sahara, taking a long table near the back, and listened to a bald-headed little comedian named Don Rickles, who was probably more caustic than any other comic in the country. His humor is so rude and such bad taste that it offends no one because it's too offensive to be offensive. Spotting Eddie Fisher among the audience, Rickles proceeded to ridicule him as a lover, saying it was no wonder that he could not handle Elizabeth Taylor. And when two businessmen in the audience acknowledged that they were Egyptians, Rickles cut into them and their country's policy toward Israel. And he strongly suggested that the woman seated at one table with her husband was actually a hooker. When the Sinatra crowd walked in, Don Rickles could not be more delighted. Pointing to Sinatra's pal, Jilly Rizzo, Rickles yelled, "How's it feel to be Frank's tractor?" Yeah, Jilly keeps walking in front of Frank, clearing the way. Then, nodding to Leo DeRocher, a former baseball player, Rickles said, "Stand up, Leo. Show Frank how you slide." Then he focused on Sinatra, not failing to mention Mia Farrow, nor that he was wearing a toupee, nor to say that Sinatra was washed up as a singer. And when Sinatra laughed, everybody laughed. And Rickles pointed toward Joey Bishop and said, "Bishop keeps checking with Frank to see what's funny." Then after Rickles told some Jewish jokes, Dean Martin stood up and yelled, "Hey, you're always talking about the Jews, never about the Italians." And Rickles cut him off. "What do we need the Italians for? All they do is keep the flies off our fish." Sinatra laughed. They all laughed. And Rickles went on this way for nearly an hour until Sinatra, standing up, said, All right. Come on, get this thing over with. I gotta go." "Shut up and sit down," Rickles yelled. "I've had to listen to you sing." "Who do you think you're talking to?" Sinatra yelled. "Dick Hames," Rickles replied, and Sinatra laughed again. And then Dean Martin, pouring a bottle of whiskey over his head, entirely drenching his tuxedo, pounded the table. By 4 a.m., Frank Sinatra led the group out of the Sahara, some of them carrying their glasses of whiskey with them, sipping it along the sidewalk and into the cars. And then, returning to the Sands, they walked into the gaming casino. It was still packed with people. The roulette wheels were spinning, the crapshooters were screaming in the far corner. Frank Sinatra, holding a shot glass of bourbon in his left hand, walked through the crowd. He, unlike some of his friends, was perfectly pressed, his tuxedo tie precisely pointed, his shoes unsmudged. He never seems to lose his dignity, never lets his guard completely down, no matter how much he is drunk, nor how long he's been up. He never sways when he walks like Dean Martin, nor does he dance in the aisles or jump up on the tables like Sammy Davis. A part of Sinatra, no matter where he is never there. There's always a part of him, though sometimes a small part, that remains il padrone. The crowd that had gathered around him now opened to let him through. But a woman stopped in front of him, handing him a piece of paper. He signed it, and then he said, "Thank you." In the rear of the Sands' large dining room was a long table reserved for Sinatra. The dining room was fairly empty at this hour, with perhaps 24 other people in the room, including a table of 4 unescorted young ladies sitting near Sinatra. On the other side of the room, at a long table, sat 7 men shoulder to shoulder against the wall, 2 of them wearing dark glasses, all of them eating quietly, speaking hardly a word, just sitting and eating and missing nothing. The Sinatra party, after getting settled and having a few more drinks, ordered something to eat. The table was about the same size as the one reserved for Sinatra whenever he's at Jilly's in New York, and the people seated around this table in Las Vegas were mainly the same people who are often seen with Sinatra at Jilly's restaurant in New York, or at a restaurant in California, or in Italy, or in New Jersey, wherever Sinatra happens to be. When Sinatra sits to dine, his trusted friends are close. And no matter where he is, no matter how elegant the place may be, there's something of the neighborhood showing because Sinatra, no matter how far he has come, is still something of the boy from the neighborhood. Only now, he can take his neighborhood with him. In some ways, the quasi-family affair at the reserved table in a public place is the closest thing Sinatra now has to home life.
Geta Lee's reading an excerpt of his 1966 article, Sinatra Has a Cold, which was first published in Esquire magazine. His reading was recorded for This American Life, which is produced at WBEZ in Chicago and distributed by Public Radio International. Our thanks to Ira Glass and Peter Clowney.